The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Thank you. Thank you. April 2nd, 1972, a U.S. surveillance aircraft is shot down and its sole survivor ejects in the heart of enemy territory. In the next several days, failed rescue attempts would result in 4 aircraft lost, 10 casualties, and others captured or trapped behind enemy lines. On April 10th, Lieutenant Thomas Norris led a 5-man team deep into enemy territory to bring the downed airmen to safety. These were highly skilled covert operatives, Navy SEALs, men whose legendary training placed them among the American military's elite. The events that followed would earn Lieutenant Norris the country's highest military award, the Medal of Honor. But the story does not stop there. Several months later, Norris would handpick Michael Thornton for another covert operation behind enemy lines. He would later say that was the smartest thing he ever did, for as he lay unconscious and critically wounded, Thornton would risk everything to not only bring Norris and another wounded comrade off the beach through hostile enemy fire, but also to swim 2 hours with them to safety, earning Thornton the distinction of being the only Medal of Honor recipient in over a century to save the life of another recipient. Tonight, our program comes to you from the Thorne Auditorium on the campus of Northwestern University and is presented in association with the Chicago Humanities Festival. Thanks to the Pritzker Military Library's season sponsors, the McCormick Tribune Foundation, Turtle Wax, and our individual sponsors and associate members for making this program possible. Thomas Norris graduated from the University of Maryland in 1967. He enlisted in the Navy, volunteered for the SEALs, and served multiple tours in Vietnam. Following his military career, Norris joined the FBI, retiring in 1999. Michael Thornton grew up on a farm in South Carolina, joined the Navy out of high school in 1967, and completed the rigorous Navy SEAL training program. Mike Thornton's distinguished Navy career would continue through Operation Desert Storm. Please join me in welcoming Medal of Honor recipients Thomas Norris and Michael Thornton. Well, these are always absolutely special times for us at the Pritzker Military Library, and now we're sharing it with a larger audience here at the Thorne Auditorium, and I really thank both of you for joining us tonight. It's just a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having us here, Ed.
Thank you, Ed.
I'm going to start tonight with a little bit of the origin of the SEALs and talk through the training program a little bit, and then we'll get to the actions, individual actions, and this very interesting intermixing of your lives that's occurred since 1972. But Tom, can you tell us? There's a lot of people from the military out here, but let's start from the beginning. What are the SEALs? And give us an overview of the history that brought them up to Vietnam.
The SEALs are a unique unit within the Naval Special Warfare community. It's designed to run covert counter-guerrilla type operations when it was first formed. It was formed by President Kennedy in 1962 when he commissioned all the services to come up with a special warfare capability, and the Navy came up with a Navy SEAL team. And SEAL stands for sea, air, and land, which is the methods we can use to infiltrate an area. Actually, the members of the SEALs came from our underwater demolition teams, which were originally formed in 1943 to help our invasion forces throughout World War II. They were formed mostly from Seabees and in Fort Pierce, Florida, and remained as a operative unit up through when were they formed as SEALs, called SEALs?
1983.
And when all of the teams now became Navy SEALs because of the requirements of our new conflicts.
What was the concept of the groups? They were in teams?
We were initially formed to operate in small units. We would deploy as a 14-man team, 2 officers and 12 enlisted, and then subdivide into 2 squads, 1 officer and 7 enlisted. and run covert missions always against superior enemy forces. Our missions were initially intelligence gathering, but because of the types of intelligence we were coming up with, there wasn't enough Army personnel to carry out those missions, so we started running them on our own. Also, at the time, Vietnam was a conflict we were involved in. All of the territories in Vietnam were I Corps, 2 Corps, 3 Corps, 4 Corps, were all Army controlled, and the only one the Navy had was the Rungsat Special Zone. And so we were designed to keep that shipping channel open, but expanded from there into aggressive assault-type operations.
Mike, you you joined the Navy right out of high school, and how were you recruited for the SEALs? How did they do their recruiting?
Well, back then they didn't do recruiting. Basically, you joined the Navy, and of course back then it was called Underwater Demolition Recruit Training, and you used to do almost have to do 2 years active duty before you could actually volunteer for UDT. And at that time, in the mid-60s, SEAL Team wasn't heard of, hadn't been made public to our country at that time. And I joined the Navy and lucked out and out of boot camp, and I went aboard a small ship, and it was decommissioned right away. And I took the training, the screening test, and went right into underwater demolition training there in Coronado, California.
How many? There were about 120 or 30 in the group?
There were 129 in my class. We graduated with 16, and actually four of those 16 got rolled back to the following class.
So we're talking about 80% dropout rate.
And during my class. And it's been, actually, we had a class that never was, and actually the class went all the way through, and they dropped down only one person, so they had to roll him back because he didn't have a swim buddy, and you can't, as long as they had a swim buddy, so you have no swim buddy.
Yeah. Was that during the time you were training? Is that when you came up with the phrase that you told me this morning?
Yeah. The only easy day is yesterday, so.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Right. How about you, Tom? How did you end up in the SEALs?
Well, when I actually went into the service, I went into the flight program. The Navy decided that, in all its wisdom, that I was probably a lot safer not flying one of their airplanes. So the only other option that I had read an article in Reader's Digest about SEAL operations, and that intrigued me. So when I went back to Pensacola for my board, aeronautical board, they happened to have a screening program to get into the SEALs, and I took the test, passed it, and was accepted to the program. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look back at this training program, are there parts of this that live with you today? I mean, this is a way of life for you.
It's a camaraderie. I mean, it's a confidence in each other that you feel. It's a camaraderie of teamwork. It's a camaraderie of friendship. You trust in each other's life together. I mean, I'm really glad that Tommy did flunk out of flight school because it was very possible I wouldn't be here today. So, but it's something that you build up just like a family, and it's your own private family.
What particular skills were they looking for in candidates?
I feel that, I've always said there's three different issues. First, it's mental. Second, it's physical. And third is to get the job done, basically. So if you aren't mentally capable to do the job in the first place, you should never be there. We'll get you in the physical shape to do the job. Then after that, it's to learn your skills, how to shoot, demolitions, intelligence, and all that kind of stuff. But if you don't have the mental capability, you're no good to anyone.
Mm-hmm. What did you say?
He's absolutely right. And mental is a big process, making it through the training program, which is a very rigorous program. And the overall feature that they're looking for is the fact that you'll continue to drive and not give up, no matter what the obstacles are that put her in front of you. Even if they're more strenuous than your body or you can physically do, as long as you continue to drive ahead, that's what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And they want to make sure as well that you never, ever, ever leave your buddy.
Mm-hmm. So the SEALs in 1962 were established for what purpose in Vietnam? What was their original purpose then?
The original purpose was to run unconventional warfare missions. When we started out in Vietnam, we were as advisors. It happened in 1961. Teams really didn't get fully deployed until probably 1965 time frame. Although we had advisors over there prior to that time, and we were intelligence gatherers, and we were initially we were training the South Vietnamese to run specialty ops, and after that, as well as other groups, part of the we ran a PROOV program, which is part of the CIA-sponsored program. But when we teams deployed, we ran intelligence gathering missions as well as direct operations against enemy forces.
Now, we may have covered this, but I just want to make sure. How many were active at the beginning of Vietnam, and what was the highest number of
When we started in 1962, we had 75 SEALs, basically, in on the West Coast. Then later on, about 4 months later, they started SEAL Team 2 on the East Coast. So we had approximately maybe 150 SEALs. Our greatest number during Vietnam got up to over 500, and then basically we had young men who would go through training, and because we were way over our complement, they actually made them go back to sea, then come back later on. So
these, when the teams were formed for these actions, for these missions, what was the makeup of the team? What were you looking for to make up this particular group of individuals?
Well, just like Tommy said, at the time for a platoon, you usually went over as a platoon operator first, and depending on your skills, like I went over in platoon first, and the rest of my tours I went over as an advisor, basically. So you would come back, they would evaluate, you know, how you handled yourself, everything like that. And could you handle leadership, the ability, then they would put you with PROOVs, or they put you with the LDNNs, which are Vietnamese SEALs, or they put you with the Kit Carson Scouts, which were actually XVC, then you would actually run the whole program.
When the Navy started the SEAL training program, when the SEAL program, it was a totally unique animal to the Navy. The Navy really wasn't even very acceptive of it, and we had nowhere to go for our training, so we went to the other services. We went to Special Forces to learn what they had. We went to Ranger School, Special Forces School. We got some Marine Recon training. We got medical training, and then we came back and put our own program together, and we utilized everything that we could possibly attend to learn how to conduct unconventional warfare.
Was there a sense when you were training that of what you were going to be facing? I mean, did you have a kind of an understanding, or was it?
Yeah, because every time a group would come back, they would debrief everyone. In other words, an area of operation, they debrief on the new booby traps they would see. They would debrief you on things to look out for, you know, on trails and things like that. They'd debrief you on anything that was not familiar with that. And then what we would do with this, they would put it in the training to the SEAL indoctrination training, which were the new guys, or the SEAL special ops training, which was the older guys, basically, the guys going over as advisors. Then the guys from SEAL Team 2, they would come over to SEAL special ops training there. Then they'd go over as advisors. So we had one special ops training for both SEAL Team 1 and 2 back then.
So you'd be constantly adjusting, basically.
All the time.
Because the war
all
changes, the conditions change. And it teaches you to adapt to any situation that you're in.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Okay. So take us up. It's probably not fair to skip most of the Vietnam War to get to 1972, but all of the things that were happening with the SEALs through that period were starting to wind down in 1972. There was a very small force there.
Correct. Actually, November of 1971 was the last platoon, and after that it was just SEAL advisors, basically, and it was so many officers plus so many enlisted guys, and you worked in an advisory capability.
So how many people, how many SEALs were there at that time in the complement? In early 72?
Well, in early 72, when I came with Tom, we had a Commodore, and he was in charge of all the Navy SEALs, the Navy divers, the UDT, and also EOD groups. Mm-hmm. Which captain was Captain Shibley, and then we had a senior SEAL officer, which was Tommy Nelson. Then and he was outside the field. Then Tommy was a senior officer in the field, which he had two other officers underneath him. And I think how many enlisted guys we had? We had nine.
So someone under 15.
Yeah,
total.
So we had three officers and nine enlisted in the field.
Okay. Well, Tom, take us up to April 1972. This is occurring. This surveillance plane goes down. It sounds like there was only one known survivor from that plane. There were a lot of other activity that kind of perpetuated a problem. Give us a sense of what you were facing.
I got introduced into this. I was back in Saigon. We had a new team lead. I was a member of a very special group then called MacSog. And I don't know if people know what that is, but it was a cover name, Studies and Military Assistance Command Studies and Observation Groups. And we were the ones that ran a lot of covert operations, most of the covert operations in and out of country. But I had a new commander coming in as part of that group, and I had gone to Saigon to brief him. And during that briefing, we received a phone call from Joint Personnel Recovery Center, an individual by the name of Colonel Anderson. Anderson had worked for MacSog. That unit had shut down since we were pulling out of the war and had gone to work for Personnel Recovery Center. And at that time, what we knew was that there had been one aircraft shot down with one survivor, Lieutenant Colonel Hambleton. The other five people on the aircraft died. In an attempt to rescue him, the Army lost. Initial attempt on the first day was two Cobra gunships and two Hueys. One of the Hueys went down with a four-man crew. One was captured. Three were killed. Followed by the next day, a number of Jolly Green Giant rescue helicopters were shot down. We went to 7th Air Force to try and recover these people. At the end of that day, they also lost another forward air controller, which was two people, Captain Henderson and First Lieutenant Mark Clark. Henderson was captured. Clark was now another on the ground. Another series of rescue efforts after that resulted in a Jolly Green Giant being shot down with a six-man crew. And the following day, another forward air controller was shot down with Bruce Walker, who was a pilot, and Larry Potts, who was a Marine artilleryman. It was riding backseat. Never heard from Potts, but Walker was on the ground. So now we had three people on the ground in a enemy-controlled area. We didn't know how many enemy were there. We later found out that because there was like two bridges across the river that they were on, a Dong Hao Bridge and a Cam Lo Bridge. Dong Hao Bridge had been blown up by two Marines, an extraordinary heroic act to keep the enemy from crossing into Dong Hao. That left the Cam Lo Bridge, which is right where these pilots were shot down. So all the North Vietnamese armored tank units moved to Cam Lo Bridge, and it was over 30,000 North Vietnamese in that area when I was asked to go in and try a ground rescue effort.
So you knew the situation was pretty high intensity at this point in time, and you had to put together this group. Did you have any idea what was going to happen?
Well, from the point of view of, I knew I had to move through an awful lot of bad guys, and I knew I had to bring back three Americans. Yeah. So it was kind of open and shut to me. It was a matter of how that was going to be accomplished.
So tell us what happened.
Well, initially, after we got approval through the Vietnamese, because it was their areas that we were in, operating in. We were set up at a base area, which was the last known safe post forward. It was like a cement bunker with a guard force of about 20 South Vietnamese and three tanks, which had just been in a battle a few days prior with North Vietnamese tanks, and there were some of those that they had destroyed below. None of them had been resupplied, and we worked out of that area. It was myself five Vietnamese, an officer, a chief, and three enlisted, along with Colonel Anderson. He went with me to the forward base. And our mission was, we had initially been briefed that we were going to patrol down to the Mugang River. Recovery plan was to try and talk these downed pilots into navigating to the river, get in the river, float down, and we were going to be swimming upstream to intercept them. Unfortunately, the people that did the planning weren't familiar with river operations. They weren't aware of the tides and how that changes the current of the river, what we would have to be swimming against, which was about a knot and a half to 2 knot current, which is a terrible current to swim against. And having to deal with the area that we would have had to cover in the river. So my option was to patrol to an area we could intercept these folks. We could only get one pilot out the first day. That was Mark Clark. He understood the mission, which was kind of interesting. We passed it to him. We couldn't do it. The North Vietnamese had our radios. We knew that. We knew they were listening. We knew they were blowing. They were obviously destroying our aircraft that were in there trying to perform a rescue. So we had to give him a code in order to move. And he was from Idaho, as a matter of fact, same place I'm from. He had been there at one time. He lived in Boise. The code was to travel from, go to the Big Suwannee and act like Esther Williams and go from Boise to Pocatello. Well, he couldn't remember where Pocatello was, so we kind of had to tell him, swim to the Atlantic. But I mean, go to the Atlantic. But yeah. And then he got the idea. And
he floated by you, and you couldn't.
He did float by us. We patrolled to a position where we should intercept him. Yeah. We heard him coming down, heavy breathing in the water. But at the same time, we had an enemy patrol right on top of us. We couldn't take the chance of trying to do an intercept with him and what he might say to alert them. So we let him pass by, and then I went in the water after that to try and catch him, and I could not find him, which was very scary because here I let this guy get by me. So I worked my way up the bank just in case he had pulled over and was resting, all the way back up to where my troops were. Made a radio call back to Colonel Anderson and told him that we had missed him and that the next time he makes a radio contact with the forward air controller to tell him just to hold up and we will pick him up. And of course, Colonel Anderson wanted to know what happened, and I'm sitting out there in the middle of no man's land with a bunch of bad guys around me and I don't want to talk to him. Yeah. So it was kind of like, yeah. Radio was off. So, we did do a patrol. We came upon him early the next morning. He was hiding in by the riverbank, and of course, once I saw him, I took off all my clothes to make me look more American. And I'm talking to him with codes that he knew to recognize me as an American. And he finally just stood up, and you could just see the relief in his in his body. And about that time, my Vietnamese companions came over the top of the bank of the canal river, and his heart sank. He thought he'd been had for sure, but we got rehabilitated him again and got him back to breathing normally and put him in the patrol and worked him back to camp. That day we got hit very heavily by shore batteries, our forward base.
Yeah.
We got hit very heavily by our shore by artillery and B-52 rockets right across the bank from us. We lost probably half of that support group there. My officer was hit right next to me. I'd gone up to Andy Anderson, was hit with a piece of frag in his eye, right above his eye. I patched him up, bandaged him, and then went up to try and call in air support. And at about that time, an incoming came in. And I don't know how you describe this other than the fact that you sense things before they happen. You have like a sixth sense you develop. The officer that was with me was a dynamite Vietnamese officer. He and I just hit the bank, and this round went off and just wiped out where we had been and tore off a good portion of his arm. So we had to medevac him. And we had to, while these incoming were coming in, we had to, it just froze. The other Vietnamese were there, so we had to run around and throw them in cover and direct fire against the rocket attack that we were receiving. And we finally got all that cleared up and medevaced everybody out of there. And for the next 2 days, we worked with a very minimal group. We never knew whether those people were going to be there when we came back or not. But eventually we made a couple attempts. We're not able to locate Hamilton. We were moving him by golf courses. He was an avid golfer. So we would give him a course to play. You're on the 17th hole at Tucson Umpty-Ump, and he would know what that course looked like and what whether it was dog leg left or whatever, and he would pace off the distance and then take the dog leg, and then we'd move him to the next course. And we worked him down to the river, but he just really, he was 53 years old, was not used to being on the ground, had not been resupplied, although a resupply mission had been attempted. And I had two different points. And one said it was hung up on an airplane. Another one said they dropped it 50 yards from him, but he couldn't get to it. The forward air controllers told me that this fella is just not going to make it. They did do a 52 strike to try and suppress some of the enemy, but I decided the only way to get him out was, I knew I was going to have to carry him, take a sampan up, move him back down the river. And that's what I myself and one of the other Vietnamese did. I told him I was going to leave early the next morning and go up that evening. And he looked at me and he said, "Dai Huy, I'll go if you go." So he went with me.
You laid him in the bottom of the boat.
So we finally got to hold of him. We went by a lot of enemy units on the way up there. We went by sleeping guard posts. We came out. We came in a heavy fog, came out early the next morning. Camelo Bridge was supposed to be bombed. Wasn't. There was North Vietnamese troops all over it. But it gave me a pointer of where he was. I had coordinates. We found him, loaded him into the sampan, covered him with bamboo vegetation, and took off downstream. We were seen by a Vietnamese patrol who chased us. We were able to evade them. And as we were heading down the river, we had no air support. We called for air support, the soonest they could get us any was fast movers. The soonest they could get us was probably 40 minutes, and the slow movers much longer than that. We were heading down the last stretch of the river. A fellow in a bunker complex opened up on us with a machine gun. We just beached the sampan. I called in an airstrike. We got F-4s came in to help us, did a wonderful job. We gave them all the other sites to try and hit, but they were pretty much out of ammo by then. And I asked, right behind them was A-1s, a very close air support aircraft, prop-driven. And I asked them to strafe both banks in case they were had enemy closing on me and to drop smoke, which they did. As soon as the smoke evolved, we got back in the sampan, used the smoke as a cover to go by that bunker position and then worked our way back to base areas.
You said to me that as a result of this mission, there were a lot of changes that came about as a way that the SEALs would operate. What are a couple of the things they
did? Not so much the SEALs, but the way rescue missions were run. They reevaluated the whole rescue program, and they have utilized that in our current conflicts. They looked at it now with not just using an Air Force means as the only option for picking up people, our friendlies that have been shot down. They now incorporate ground units as well. And they have changed the way they look at or operate those rescue programs. And I can't go into all of that, but major changes were made as a result of that particular mission.
Well, your mission was declassified in 1975. And you were put in for the medal at that point. We're going to kind of talk about that afterwards because the story does not end with the sampan and the brush because sometime in June, was it May or June? End of May, early June of 1972, Mike Thornton comes back to Vietnam for his fourth tour.
Fourth tour.
And this is the first time you two have met.
That's
during
right.
this time. And again... you're here for the summertime. What was the summer like, the summer of 72 for you?
Summer of 72 for me, actually, was just like any other time in Vietnam, basically. When I got there, I met Tom. Tom discussed with me. We had 9 enlisted troops, as we said before. We had 2 young officers on their first tour were there. And Tom discussed with me how we should break up the group. Even though I wasn't the senior enlisted guy, I was kind of voted in as the senior enlisted guy because I had more experience than any of the other guys. Now, we had several other guys that were on their third tours and several guys that were on their second tours of Vietnam, so we had some experience over there. Then we had quite a few young guys. I think 4 it was on their first tour, which we divided. Tom and I discussed it, and we divided up, and we took the young guys and put them with me and kept 2 of the guys that were on their second tour. And we took the other experienced guys, Gary Chamberlain, Harry Konnakula, and these other guys were on their third tour, and put them with the other group.
Well, with things winding down that summer, what was a day like? What was a day like in the the area?
Well, we get up and we train PT.
We were there as advisors to our Vietnamese counterpart, the LDNs, and we were there to instruct them or assist them in running unconventional operations. And that's what we did. We would have training set up to teach them the different methods of operation, the use of some of the weaponry that we had, and we ran missions with them. And that's why we tried to put experienced operators with less experienced people so that they could utilize that experience to learn the best methods to operate in a hostile environment.
As Tommy was saying, in September of that year, all American troops left, and we'd have to go clear all our operations to the province level, basically, or the in charge of whatever province it was and stuff like that to get clearance for operations. And that period of time was really hard, but we were able to clear for several different type of operations and move in and still be able to train these guys.
Okay. Well, it's October 31st, 1972, and another mission comes up, and you're the commander, and you want to get five guys that all look like Vietnamese. They're all about 5'8" and slight build, and
except him.
And you choose Mike Thornton,
who
kind of
like
stands out there. He's like, what were you thinking?
You should see Mike trying to make himself small.
Yeah. What were you thinking about Mike Thornton?
I had not operated with Mike before in the field. I knew his reputation. I knew the experience level that he had, and obviously the other experienced enlisted operators that I had. There was no doubt about who had the most experience and time in field. This mission was one that was requested by my CO, who was the direct advisor to the Vietnamese commander of the LDNN group. He requested us to go up and see whether or not the Quang Viet Naval Base could be retaken by the Vietnamese, and also the Americans wanted us to know if there was any anti-aircraft or SAM sites or any of that put up there. And I looked at Uncle Dave and I said, I can tell you what's up there without ever going. And you know, Uncle Dave, he was one of these ex-enlisted guys that came up to the ranks. You would do anything that he asked you to do. He was one of those folks that had been there and done that. And if he asked you, there was a reason. He asked me if I would take the mission. I said, absolutely. Do I get to pick my team? And he said, well, you can pick your enlisted, but the officer's already going to be chosen for you. I said, fine. So I went up and briefed Mike, and I said, Mike, this is where we're going. Pick the best you can and take lots of bullets.
I went back and chose two LDNN SEALs. I'd worked on two previous tours, and I knew these guys were combat ready. And we'd been in a lot of firefights, been surrounded a lot of times, and these guys were always there for you. They never would leave you, and no matter how bad it got, they was always there with you. So I had the same confidence in them that I knew that Tommy and I had in each other. So
you go up the river. Mm-hmm. You go up a little too
no,
far.
We don't go up a river.
We don't go up a river. We go up the South China Sea.
South China Sea.
We're in a cement junk, and I had pre-programmed or pre-arranged naval ships to give us our vectors into where we were going. Mm-hmm. Pre-gunfire, naval gunfire positions in case we got in trouble. Unfortunately, Quang Tri City was then being overrun. They were trying to maintain Quang Tri City, which was 20 miles south of us.
South of us, yeah.
Of where our objective was, and so the naval gunfire ship, all the naval ships were brought down there to help artillery support for that mission, so they were not available. We continued our travels up the South China Sea, and the Vietnamese officer in charge talked to the captain of the ship we were on, cement junk, and assured me he could vector us into where we needed to go, and we went with that. Unfortunately, we were sent in way north of where we should have been, and we were. Left the ship, went on a little rubber
Zodiac, not a Zodiac, IBS.
The rubber boat, and they dropped us off. And we inserted, and Mike had a starlight scope, and we started out on this patrol, and with a starlight scope, you should have been able to see the Quaviet River, and he couldn't see it. And he, Mike's at the end of the line. He'd come up to me, and he used to call me Nasty, and he'd say, Nasty. I don't see the Quaviet, which means we aren't where we're supposed to be. And I said, okay, Mike, we're just patrolling ahead. And we did. We just took off to continue that operation. And the reason I did that was, and Mike wasn't aware of this, was the officer that they had chosen to run that mission with the Vietnamese was, I've run a couple missions with him, and he was very shaky as to initiating on a much larger enemy force. And this was the first time he was ever enthusiastic enough about running a mission. And so I said, well, let's give him the opportunity to go. So I said, we can always come back out and reinsert tomorrow night.
But I'm thinking all this time, you know, we had gone a little bit north to look for the Quaviet, didn't see it, went a little bit south and see the Quaviet. And I'm thinking all the time, where are we? And I wonder if they know where we are. But when Tommy says to go, I mean, it's that ability of that you have confidence in each other.
You went through the first night with just, you were just on patrol.
Just patrol.
But it was the next morning.
That night was a bad night.
That night. We had Tommy on the point. We had the three Vietnamese in between us and me at rear security.
We went through major regiments. Enemy positions.
I mean, there's bunkers there make this building look small. And I went up to Tommy and I said, no, they built this in 30 days, you know. So right then.
We were sneaking through this all night long.
And you could.
That's what I'm saying. You see Mike trying to make himself look like a Vietnamese.
Because my Vietnamese were about 4'8 and 5'2. As it was getting. The daylight was starting to get Tommy in, and we stopped and discussed, and we said, better get out, and we were just going to try to lay up all during the day and hide.
And extract that night,
then lay up, then go back in the right position. So as we're moving out, we got off in this little riverbed and moved slowly down through this little creek bed. It wasn't a river, just a creek bed, basically, with the high tide up, and you could tell it was going out for two reasons. And first of all, it kept us at a low silhouette. Another reason, by moving slowly, you weren't going through the brush, or hopefully you wouldn't be bumping into somebody sleeping or something, because there was bodies everywhere. I mean, bodies, many people sleeping, the units and stuff like that. And as the sun was coming up, I walked up Tommy and I said, is that a tank up there with a big red star on it? Tommy looked up there. Yep,
absolutely.
I think you're right, Mike. Sure is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like that. So, you know, but as we patrolled during the evening, we knew that we were in North Vietnam at that time right off the bat. So
take us through the firefight where Tommy was injured.
Well, we moved back out to the beach, and when we got to the beach, we passed a village to the south of us, so we didn't want to go south, and there was no cover. So we went north, and we saw this large lagoon off to inland, which would give us the ocean on our eastern flank and this gigantic lagoon on our western flank. And there was a gigantic sand dune, and after Tommy got up there, it was actually a bunker. But there's no one in it, thank God. And then we had several dunes spread out to the south of us. Then from the north of that bunker, there was one big bunker, not another big bunker, but a fairly sized sand dune about 500 yards away. And Tommy thought that was the best position for us to try to lay up and hide. And there was some foliage along the lagoon because the water, we was able to grow along the water because the water was fresh water, brackish water. And so we just laid up, and Tommy got up on the top of the dune to try to get the best view, but also to try to get radio communications. And I'll let you go on with the radio communications.
Well, we were in a pretty secure position. It was not a bad spot to have to stay. We had to lay up. Unfortunately, there was a patrol that came down
the beach.
And we're just watching them, patrol work their way down the beach. And all of a sudden, the officer with us, I guess he thought we were going to be gathering intel, but he hollers out for his enlisted guys to go and capture these folks. And I look over and I go, wrong thing to do. So there are these guys, they jump up and they head out there, what their officer told them to do, and they're trying to catch these guys. And, of course, the firefight started, and all of a sudden, where that tank used to be, just pops up with bodies of North Vietnamese.
Actually,
you know, Mike looked at me. We got trouble. I said, absolutely.
Well, I knocked this one guy out with the butt of my weapon and went chasing the other guy, and I was going to try to run him down before he could get back to the village, and I wasn't able to make it. So, like Tommy said, we turned up, and all hell broke loose at that time. It was approximately 50 to 75 NVA, and they started moving in on us. So at that period of time, I moved
against your force of five.
Against our force of five.
So we took the young officer at that time. I knew he wasn't what we needed to be. So we put him on rear security and just basically told him, watch for anything that comes there. If you do, tell Tommy. And I took myself, and Dang was up on the hill with Tom with the radio. And that way they had a good view. And I moved out on the forward point as far as I could do, as long as I had cover. Then I put Quan on my eastern flank, that they couldn't flank us from around the ocean, because at that time the tide was real, real low. And with the tide, I'd give him an open, but give him plenty of area to be able to try to stop any attack along the side. So I was approximately, 100 yards or so in front of everyone. And what I'd do, I'd start shooting, and I would hit a guy, and he'd fall and hit another guy, and I'd roll over, and I'd come up in another position, then I'd kill a few guys there, then I'd roll over in another position. But of course, the force, and I look back, and I could see Tommy up there shooting, but on the radio too, trying to get, and what was going on at the radio, I'll let him tell you, because all the firefighting, I was down there, I didn't know what was going on the radio.
We had our hands full. I was trying to contact to get naval gunfire in to help us out. And the first ship I got, the operator I was talking to was fairly young, and I mean, knew it ever assisting troops on the field, close in support like that. And I'd given him coordinates and positions and the type of rounds I wanted him to fire. And you know, we didn't. I mean, of course, you're shooting in between all of this, and you have to put the radio down, and you're fighting the forces that are attacking us. And the next time I got up on the radio, I got a totally different person, and I'm talking to him, and it's kind of like I got to go through this whole program again. I thought I'd just explain that to him already. I didn't realize I was talking to another ship, but I was. And because the first one had been hit by shore batteries from North Vietnam, the second ship, shore batteries came in so close they had to divert. And by the time I finally talked to a ship that could assist me, it was the Newport News, and they were able to give us covering fire, but in that period of time, and it's over.
The whole firefight lasted almost during that period of time.
And 5 hours.
We kept moving back and back and back, and I got back. Tommy was, I'd say, back behind this wall here, and I was at a sand dune right here, and there's a bunch of guys on the sand dune about where these young cadets are, and they were throwing grenades over at me. And they threw this one grenade over, and I took it as an old Chi-Com grenade, and I threw the grenade back. I'm going 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, where American grenades are. It's a four-second instantaneous grenade. It goes off 4,000. They threw it back. I'm going 8,000, 9,000. I grab it, and I throw it back over there. I'm going 10,000, 12,000, 14,000. You know, you do all 1,000. It came back for the fifth time. I said, oh, hell. So I rolled over, and the grenade went off, and I was hit six times with shrapnel on my back, and I yelled. And you could hear Tommy yelling, Mike, buddy, Mike, buddy. I wouldn't say nothing. I just kind of laid on my back, and about that time, four guys came running over the top, and I.
But before that, I mean, I'm hollering at him, and I'm thinking he's hit, so I'm moving on around to get to him to you know, give him aid if I can. And about that time,
these guys come over the top, and I shot all four. Two fell on top of me, and the other two fell backwards, and we couldn't understand that this onslaught stopped. But Tommy said, how do you think we're doing? I said, I don't know. I said, I've killed 33 so far. I mean, at least I know they didn't get up again, because they would take their head up, which, like I said, and they would always put their head up the same place at the sand. So when I saw their head come up, see the top of their head, I'd hit about 1 inch below the sand. In the sand, you go, boom, you get a perfect shot. Boom, it was it. Then you just roll over. So the reason I would roll over, that way they couldn't pinpoint where I was, but also it gave them a faint experience how many personnel we really had.
You always move,
keep moving all the time. That they can't really pinpoint you, but the other reason it gives them, they didn't know if we had 10 people or 5 people or 100 people. They really didn't, because they were getting hit from areas at the top with Tom and with Dang along the flanks over there, and I just kept sweeping back and forth across the flank, because you could see them moving. You know, you could see like 4 or 5 were moving it this way and 2 would stay back that way, so I'd go over and try to attack the major group come over. So after I killed those four people, and Tommy said, and I finally answered, Tommy, I'm all right. Everybody kind of started laying back, and we couldn't understand why they were falling back. So I crawled up and talked to Tom, and I said, no, the wounds are just shrapnel wounds. I'll be okay. And he said, wonder why they fell back. And I look across, I'm looking over, I'm trying to gaze them like this. And I look across the lagoon, I said, I can tell you why. I can't say, I just counted 75 guys, and there's a whole bunch behind them, and it was the 283rd NBA battalion or something.
They were trying to circle
us. They were trying to surround us. So they had guys going the south of the lagoon and around to the north of the lagoon. And that's when Tommy, and you could see him already coming around to the south of the lagoon. Tommy said, Mike, you take Quan and Ty and fall back to that sand dune and cover our...
And he'll cover you.
Yeah,
he stayed to cover you, your movement.
Remove.
And that's when...
But a lot of people don't... The first guy knocked out, our Dane was interrogating this guy, and we finally found out where we were, pointed out on the map. And he was down in the... sitting here at Tommy's feet, basically. We had him all wrapped up. And so when the firefight started, Dang was interrogating this guy to find out, and finally showed us, and that way is how we knew exactly to bring the Newport News in to give us gunfire support. And
which I had coordinated.
He had coordinated.
We hadn't gotten any incoming rounds yet, so.
So you're covering their movement back.
Yes. Correct.
And you are hit.
I'm hit. I was on a sand dune. I had a little rocket. I was getting ready to shoot that at a group that was coming at us, and I took a round in the head. Just picked me up and just knocked me for a loop off the sand dune. I wasn't unconscious. It just totally, knocked me off of my position. And I grabbed my AK. I was carrying an AK-47 and tried to get back into give covering fire. And probably 30 seconds, I don't know. You see the enemy coming at you, but you also see tunnel vision coming in, and boom, I was just out.
Who saw you? Who saw the
list of guys?
Dang, the radio operator. And he got back to me. I said, where's Tommy? He said, Mike Dowie's dead. And he had been hit twice in the back of the radio, and luckily he had two pieces of metal embedded in his back. And I said, are you sure? He said he was shot in the head. He saw Tommy when he fell. And I said, y'all stay here. I'll go back and get Tommy. And he says, no, Mike, he's dead. They said, they're all coming. And I said, y'all stay here. So I went running back. When they saw me rushing the position, of course, sand was flying everywhere. How they missed me, I haven't figured it out yet.
Did you think about that at all? I mean, was there ever a moment where you...
No, because I knew Tom would... It goes back to that mental thing. You know, if you don't have that, satisfaction, or you don't... not say satisfaction. I mean, if you don't have that guarantee that I'll be there for him or he'll be there for me, I would never go in the field with him.
If you had hesitated even for a minute, Tommy wouldn't be here today.
I don't know about the hesitation, because when I started running, I was hesitating a lot because I was shooting all the way on running up there. Because when I got
how far cover did you...
Almost 500 yards
to get to...
You get to Tommy. And when I got to the top, they were coming around the bottom of the dune, and they were taking over the top where Tommy was, and I killed several people that were... actually coming over top of Tommy's body when I saw his body.
And you didn't know if he was alive or dead.
I thought he was dead. I mean, his whole...
Didn't matter.
Yeah, his whole...
We're going to leave him there.
You never leave anybody behind, right. Because, you always have a fear.
There was no movement, though, at that point.
No, because the bullet had entered the side of his temple, and I could see the whole front of his forehead was completely gone. I didn't know the severity of that. When I picked him up, I thought he was dead. So I killed these guys. I grabbed Tommy, and I threw him up on my shoulders in a fireman carry. I grabbed his AK because I knew I was all mouse. I mean, when we went in, we carried several law rockets. I'd already gone through all my grenades. I had 8 grenades on me. I had gone through all my rounds except I had 2 magazines or magazine left on. So when I grabbed Tommy, I knew he had his AK, so I grabbed his AK, and we started running down the south end of the embankment when the first round of the Newport News came in.
The air support.
And
gunfire support from the naval cruiser.
Okay. And he hit the sand dune just to the south. And when it hit, the explosion, these 8 inches, so you got a mini Volkswagen coming at you, basically, the shell. When it blew off, I flew almost 20 feet. Actually, I didn't run down this thing because this dune was about 30 feet high, you'd say. It blew me off this thing. And I landed, and I could see Tommy leaving my shoulders. And he landed at the bottom. I feared if he wasn't dead, he was dead now for sure. So I got up, and of course, this concussion knocks you loopy. And so you're getting up, and you're trying to get your everything back. And I run over, and I grab Tommy. He says, "Mike, buddy." And I said, "The SOB's alive." So I pick him back up and put him on my shoulders, and I started running. That one round gave me enough to break contact. Then they saw me running. Then they started, the onslaught came again. And I looked up, and there's my two guys, Dane and Quan, up there giving me cover fire, which, like I said, Dane had been already in the back. And when I was running back, I got to the sand dune, and I lay him down and said, "Mike," I said, where's Ty, the officer? Well, when I went back after Tommy, Ty disappeared into the water. And so we were about 300 yards from, it was low tide, we were about 300 yards from the beach, and they say, "Mike, what we do?" Well, I said, "I'm going to say, when I yell one," I said, "Quan, I want you to lay down a base of fire. When I yell two, Quan, you'll leapfrog us. When I yell two, Dane, you lay down a base of fire. Then I'll yell three, and I'll lay down a base of fire. We'll just leapfrog our way," because we could see the guys running from the north, and they were shooting at us, but they were a long ways off. But our objective there was right, the guys right there in front of us. So we got to the water's edge, and I didn't know it later on, but I fell. And when I fell, later on when I got aboard ship, I was shot through my left calf. And I failed and picked Tommy up. So I grabbed Tommy and stuck him underneath my arm like this. And I was dragging and I was shooting like this, and I feel somebody starting to flounder. What was? I had his head underneath the water, and I was So then I pick him up, and I'm holding him, and I grabbed him like this, and I was just wanting to get through the surf some, because the waves are large enough that I know we'd get some type of cover fire. And when I got to the on the other side of the surf some, they started chasing us out through the surf some, and I took my life jacket, because he had his tied around his leg, because all guys from SEAL Team 2 like to float upside down. And so I took my life jacket. I took my life jacket off, and later on I asked him this question. And I put it over his head, and I took the strap and put it around my neck. I didn't want to inflate it because I didn't want him to be floating too high. And so I was breaststroking, and as I was breaststroking out, I look over, and there's Quan, the little guy, and he was fluttering in the water. He had been shot, and he had lost the whole right side of his hip. So I grabbed him, pulled him to me, put his arms underneath my arms, and he grabbed Tommy, and we started swimming. And the whole time, you could just see, like you see in the movies, the bullets going through the water, because I was really breaststroking. You could just see the bullets just going through the water, and I just said, "Good Lord, don't let them hit me now."
Amazing.
And I made it worse for him, because I wanted to make sure that we had everybody, and I asked him, like, "So we got everybody?" And he says, "Yeah," and I could see the two enlisted guys, but I couldn't see the officer.
And he tried to crawl up on my back, and he pushed me underneath the water.
Finally, I pushed on him, and I could see his head way out to sea. And I guess then after that, I relaxed.
He relaxed, and he kind of blacked out. And then he'd come back, and you know, he'd let me know he was still with us. And when I got him out as far as I could, I knew we got out of the range of fire. And I'll never forget Quan and Dangling me. He says, "What do we do, Mike?" I said, "We swim south. It's a long swim, guys, but we're heading south."
2 hours, right?
Well, no, we didn't know.
We didn't know.
See, the Newport News had left.
Yeah.
That was the worst feeling I ever had in my life. I watched that ship turn around and leave. I said, "Where are they going?" You know, I said, "Where are they going?" And these guys said, "What do we do?" I said, "We swim south." And I figured we'd swim as long as we possibly could at nighttime. We'd try to come in. But I didn't know, but a Ford Observer plane had come in and took pictures, and they called him off, and he had taken pictures, and he said all he could recognize was a bunch of bodies laying all over the ground, and they thought that we were dead.
We're going to have to wrap up at this part of the program, but we're going to come back on our webcast part to finish some of this story. But I'd just like to say, gentlemen, that the story that I've just heard from the two of you for this is just incredibly remarkable, and your service to our country is truly, truly appreciated. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Ed.
And that will do it for tonight. A special thanks to Tom Norris and Michael Thornton for joining us. If you'd like to learn more about the Medal of Honor, visit Congressional Medal of Honor Society at cmohs.org. or the Medal of Honor Foundation at cmohfoundation.org. You can read more about it in the new expanded edition of Medal of Honor Portraits of Valor Beyond the Call of Duty. A special thanks to Foundation President Nick Kehoe for his assistance in making this program possible. To view this or other archived programs in our collection, or to download the podcast, visit us at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. For all the staff at the Pritzker Military Library and the Chicago Humanities Festival, I'm Ed Tracy. Thanks for joining us. I want to welcome you back for the rest of tonight's program. We'll be taking questions in just a little bit. I'd like to just finish the story. It's just I knew it was going to be that way when we started, but this is tremendous.
Yeah, well, I was swimming with Tom. I'd stopped and I took 2 4x4 battle dresses to put over his head, and he wouldn't cover his whole wound. So you can imagine his whole side of his cheekbone, his forehead was gone, the front lobe part of his brain was gone, and I thought I could feel him going in shock. And later on, as we got aboard the ship, so a good friend of ours, Woody Woodruff, in SEAL Team, we never have gone on an insertion vessel without leaving a Navy SEAL. And there's a second class petty officer by the name of Wood Woodruff. And when they said that, he thought we were down at the Quaviet. He'd been looking for us down off the Quaviet. We're actually 9 clicks north Vietnam, and he would never give up. And Woody found, there was 2 junks, and Woody found and picked up Ty, and he was debriefing Ty. He said, where's everybody else? Well, nobody could see us. And he says that Tommy was dead, and I was missing in action. He said Mike went back to get Tommy and never saw him. And he said he thought the other 2 guys followed him in the water, which they never did. So as Woody, he's the admiral of the fleet, is trying to find out what happened with the operation. Of course, to see all the Newport News and everybody else is trying to find out what went on. And Woody sent the other junk up forward looking for us, and he came up, and the other junk found us swimming in the water. And that's when we were able to push Tommy up there, and we were able to get got Quan up there, which had lost his right hip. We got Dang up there, which had 2 in bed. And so I was so exhausted, I couldn't pull myself up, which back then I could do 60 pull-ups or 1,000 push-ups, but I was completely drained. So I'm trying to pull myself up, and they couldn't. All these little Vietnamese are trying to pull me up. They couldn't get me up, so they threw over this big piece of line, this howitzer, and I tied a bowline in it, put my foot in. I was hanging like that, and they had the whole crew and everybody else are dragging me up there. Finally got me up there. So I got on the radio and told Woody that we were there, and I called the Newport News. I told them to turn around, that we had 4 wounded, and we had tried to get how serious Tommy's wound was. They said, we'll have a medical team waiting. We went alongside of the Newport News. They sent over a basket, pulled the basket up. I went up a boatswain ladder. I picked Tommy up, carried him down, and laid Tommy on the gurney. I'm there with the doctor, and they said, Mike, they want to talk to you. I said, they can wait. And I said, well, I want to check on Tom. And the doctor, they bandaged him up. They did everything they possibly do and cleaned him up and stuff like that. And the doctor says he's never going to make it. So we got a medevac on the way. So he took Tommy back to Da Nang. As Tommy said, they had pulled all the U.S. forces out in September. There's no neurosurgeons there, so they sent a 141 medevac with 2 medical teams on, picked Tommy up, took him back to the Philippines, and his first operation was about 19 and a half hours long, they called me.
But it was about a 12-hour trip, right?
12 and a half hours
to get there. So after all of this in the water, you're 12 hours in transit.
You did 12 and a half hours from the time I got shot.
From the time we got him there.
12 hours.
Yeah, it's about a 3-hour or 4.
Is there any part of that came back to you?
Yes. When I was in Da Nang, Ryan McCombie, who was another one of the SEAL officers that was there, a very, very close friend of mine, had come up because he had put together a team to come up and help find us. They were going to up and do an insertion and pull us out if they needed to. But Mike called and asked if he would intercept me when I came into Da Nang, which he did, and he sat with me. And I could remember, you know, him asking me questions, trying to keep me conscious to talk, and I would go in and out of consciousness. And I don't remember much other than that. I mean, they flew me to the Philippines. I don't remember any of that. I know when I got to the Philippines, I weighed like 142 pounds, which for me is a lot. The day before I was shot, and I think I weighed 111 pounds in the By the time I got to the Philippines.
By the time you got to the Philippines, or the lawsuit and stuff like that.
Now, you were in the hospital for three years. Was it three years?
Mm-hmm.
3 years in the hospital.
No, off and on.
Off and on.
What happened was I had to stay in the Philippines. I was stabilized and be transferred back to
Bethesda
Naval Hospital, which is where I had my initial surgeries. And because of the type of injuries I had, they could only operate every 6 months. They had to get 6 months healing time in between. So I was in the hospital for those first periods. And then after, you know, they had done a number of surgeries on me, they finally would. But when did you receive? You received yours in
73.
I was still in the hospital.
He was still in the hospital. I came back to Washington. I'd been calling and talking to the doctors and asked them how Tommy's doing and stuff. And he says he's going to be okay. You know, he says you have, you know, of course, you know, we didn't know. They were trying to put plates in, and his body wasn't actually accepting some of the plates and stuff like that. So I flew out in October of 73, and I was going to receive the medal. I found out later on that they had submitted me for the Medal of Honor, and I never thought I deserved it, and never will think I deserve it, but. I went back there and I went and visited Tommy at the hospital, and I said, and I was talking to the doctors, I said, I want to take Tommy out and I want to take him to the White House with me to receive the Medal of Honor with me. And they said, no, you're getting him prepped or something for some type of operation.
They should have known better.
They should have known better.
you,
so I went back that night and I kidnapped Tommy. And,
you picked up Tommy.
Took him to. I took him and I put
you
him.
Kidnapped
in my,
him out of the hospital.
I kidnapped him out of the hospital and I put him up underneath a fake name at the hotel we were staying at.
What was the name?
I just put you in it because I had like four rooms under my name, so they didn't know who basically was. So they were calling his mom and his dad, wanted to know where he was. And nobody knew where he was. And the first time anybody saw him was at the White House. He was standing behind me when he received the medal. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this tears me up. But the love I feel for this guy is more than you just don't know. I mean, after 35 years of loving one guy and what we've had and, you know, the trials and even after that and what's going on in our life and stuff like that, and, you know, people said, why do you do it, Mike, or why do you even stay in, or why do you do it? It's because it's the love of the camaraderie that you build in the teams, basically, and our camaraderie and love's continued after all these years, and we're still, I mean, I'm closer to him than I am my own brother, you know, and nothing away from my brother. I love him to death, too, but until you've been that close to death and war, I mean, I've been close to death. I've even lost a lot of my good friends, you know, but they disappeared, and to see what Tommy went through those 3 years and what he's done, you know, he never gave up on life itself, and that's a tribute to himself, basically. And I know when the president came up and said, Mike, what can I do for you? I said, if you can break this medal in half, I need to give the other half to this guy back there, because he would have done the same for me as I did for him. So it was a great day, and almost 3 years later, March of 1976, I was there in the White House again as Tommy received his medal.
It was 75 when his mission was declassified.
Declassified in 76.
And things are working better for you, right? You're getting out and you're around. And what was it like to be there to receive the medal? And
when I received it,
yeah.
People don't understand this, but our operations were such that you do a job that you've been sent to do, and neither Mike and I believe that what we did was worthy of such a high honor. You know, you're trained to do a mission, and you do the job you need to do in order to get it done, and you don't expect anything for that. That's what your job is. When they first asked me about what had happened, because it was a classified mission, obviously, the team wanted to put me in for, or at least submit my name for consideration for the medal, and I wouldn't provide him with it because I just didn't believe in that. And a couple things changed my mind later on, but so I finally did write down what had happened. But you know, it's
you know, the metal we both wear, so probably around our neck. It's for every
for
man
us,
and woman and young man and woman has served this or is going to serve, but most of all, it belongs
for
to
those that can't
it can't come back. You know, they've given the utmost. You know, they've given their lives for us to enjoy our freedoms today, and that's who that really belongs to.
We wear it for them.
I've been hit 18 different times, and I'm still allowed to come home and hug my buddy here and love my grandchildren and stuff like that, and my mom and dad, but those other people who's given the utmost their lives, they'll never be able to touch anybody again as long as they live. And the really sad point is their children, their moms, and their dads, their brothers and sisters will never be able to do that again. So, you know, that's who the medal really belongs to, ladies and gentlemen. It's not me. It belongs to each and one, every one of them.
Gentlemen. I am just so honored to be part of this program and to have you folks here today.
Thank you, great
to have you. I think we have some time for some questions,
sure.
And we have a couple of microphones. There's one up there. There's one up here. Please stand up and identify yourself.
Stand up, Tommy. I like to see who I'm looking at. Go ahead.
Hi. We've heard, I hope you don't think this is too unrelated, but we've heard certain comparisons between Vietnam and what's happening in Iraq, given the fact that you really put your lives on the line. Do you have any personal or strategic opinions about what's going on in the current situation, or what can you help us civilians understand this more, having seen combat yourselves?
You know, when you look at Afghanistan and you think that we took Afghanistan with 500 special operations, which now we have the Special Operations Command, and they're our joint unit, which is an outstanding unit. And the way they operated, and by taking Afghanistan, which the Russians fought it for 18 years and never was able to take it out. These young men and women, you know, but ladies and gentlemen, we all can stand back and look and talk about it, you know. But one thing I need to know about this great country of ours, you know, we all were built on values. We all were built as one nation, you know, and how you want to look at it, that's fine. But every major nation and every major empire that's ever has ever been taken over was never overtaken by force. They were taken over because they crumbled within. You know, so we have to keep a strong military at all times. You know, I believe in peace. I believe in being passive. But I carry that big sword. I'm a great St. Michael fan of mine. You know, you better always be strong, because by being passive, every time we've ever been passive, they've attacked us. And that's what people have to understand. You know, we didn't get this country by being passive. We have had to fight from the Indians, which that's not like that, from the British, from the French, from the, you know, war, the Germans, the World War I, World War II, Korea, and everything, because they wanted to take what is ours. So The combat tactics now are unbelievable. I mean, they really are. I'm proud of each one of those men and women over there. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that we have to be strong. And I look at Vietnam now, 35 years later, and it's a very democratic country over there. I don't know if any of y'all have been over there. But, I mean, they believe in democratic ways. The industry's grown greatly. They great beautiful resorts there now. You know, it took them 35 years to change over, you know. And just, but I also look how long it made our country where we are today, too. So nothing happened overnight.
Next question. This one here.
Go ahead.
Where'd it go?
You go.
It's right in the middle.
I'm sorry. Where is it?
You go, right here.
I don't see it.
Oh. Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. I very much appreciated what I heard here tonight. My question is, were you ever able to go back and reach out to your Vietnamese comrades that were with you during the fight and reestablish contact with them and what has happened to them? Thank you.
I can answer from my perspective on my particular operation. The individual, Kit, who was with me when we rescued two pilots, came out as part of the refugees, and he is just retired from Boeing Aircraft. He was awarded the
Navy Cross,
which is the highest award ever given to a foreign nation. I still do keep in contact with him, yes. The other people who were with me on that thing, during that operation, some of them were killed over in Vietnam during the offensive push.
Yeah. The young officer, Ty, that was with Tom and I, he's teaching school in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Dane, which is the guy had embedded in his back, I think he's a fisherman up in near Seattle. But Quan was he was taken in the overtake. He was never heard of. You know.
Good evening, gentlemen. First of all, it is a complete honor to be standing in the same room with you two. I'd like to know if you could give me one thought or motivational tool to take back to Recruit Training Command Great Lakes to train where we train sailors or civilians to be sailors. What motivational tool or thought would you give to me to take back to Great Lakes?
You say yours first.
Number one, that they've even chosen that field is admirable. They've chosen a profession that can be extremely rewarding if they look at it in that regard. I will never, ever be able to do the things I was able to do in the military. That's been such a huge contribution to the way I developed and what I did in my, after I came out, and I spent 20 years as an FBI agent. Suggestion is try and never dampen their enthusiasm. Try to increase that enthusiasm and that drive and in them to do the best they can in their military career, and they'll make it a very rewarding one for themselves. It's like almost anything else. If you apply yourself and you want to succeed, you're going to succeed, and you're going to make that a positive experience. And thankfully, they've chosen the field that they have to at least start out in their careers, to try and to step in and be a representative of this great country, and the extent they may have to go to in order to live up to that commitment, to a point where it may be that they need to put their lives on the line in order to protect the freedoms and the values that we have in this great country. Just encourage that in every one of them.
Yeah. My father taught me, he only had a sixth grade education. He served our country for 10 years during World War II, and he told me that you never give up. And I guess that's when I was going through training, no matter how bad I thought it was. He always said, always look at something positive in lifetime, basically. And you have to set those little goals. And I talk to people all the time going through the academies and stuff like that, because we all overwhelm ourselves sometimes, even going through boot camp or something, but you got to get through the day first. You got to live life one day at a time. You can look at those goals and set that goal out there before you have to worry about that goal way out there or that evolution. You got to get through today. So you work through the day, make it through this, then you take the next day and the next step. Because I think some people in life, and that's everyday life, that we get overwhelmed and we think we really have it, really got it bad. But we don't have it bad. We have it great. We live in the greatest country in the world, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I sometimes wish I hear all these people griping about America. I'd like to take them over to Ethiopia for about 30 days and live over there, you know, because I've been to these places, you know. And I kiss this low ground. Just be thankful that you're here. But always think positive. No matter how bad it is, somebody's got it worse. And just get to that day, and tomorrow has got a whole brighter future on it.
I think we have time for one more question.
First of all, thank you, gentlemen, for the stories that you shared with us. But could you give us an update on the POW situation and the two, as far as the government?
In Vietnam?
Correct, yeah.
Admiral Stockdale is a very close friend of mine, and so is Colonel Bud Day. And Leo Thornis, as Admiral Stockdale told me, he said, there's no more POWs over there. He said, anyone who's over there today, and he was the senior POW in Vietnam. Now, there's MIAs missing, and we know that we're still searching for those. But he said, anybody who's over there right now is over there because they want to be. In 1979, President Carter signed an amnesty note that anybody that was a deserter or anybody at any time in their life, they could come back to this country with nothing held against them. In other words, if I was in World War II and I shot Tommy and I deserted, I could come back to this country and they couldn't hold any legal. That's what people understand about that. But no, Admiral Stockdale was a very close friend. Tommy and I were honored to know him all these great years, and we were there till along to put his soul to rest. But him and Bud and everybody said, there's no more POWs over there. There are MIAs. There's people missing that we still look for even today. And it continues on to try to find everyone and bring them back home.
For those of you that don't know, Admiral Stockdale was a ranking Navy POW who received the Medal of Honor. And Bud Day was the ranking Air Force POW, both of which received at the same time I did. And I'll tell you, I was on a stage with those folks, sitting there thinking, what am I doing here next to these two guys?
Yes, sir. That's great. I'll let this young cadet say something, and we'll go. That'd be it.
Let's get a microphone.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'd just like to say it's really an honor for all us cadets from West Point being here and hearing you. It's really an inspiration to us, and we'll take the lessons you taught us and use them as platoon leaders in the Army here shortly. My question is, where do you find the driving force for courage on the battlefield in intense combat situations to be?
It goes back to that mental thing, so all in your heart.
It comes from within you. Yeah,
within you, you know. Mm-hmm. You're your worst enemy or you're your best friend. So I've told everybody, as I was an instructor at Bud's, only you ring that bell. And it goes about that mental integrity. My father says, you never give up, you never give up. No matter how bad it is, you know, when Tommy's looking down at me, he said, what are you laughing about? I said, well, crying's not going to do us no good. And I was down there laughing. I was shooting a roller here, and I'd laugh. And he said, God, I can't believe you're laughing. I said, well, you know, like I say, crying's not good. You got to look at everything. I always felt that we would get out of there. I never, even when I was hit, and I knew that Tommy was hit, and even when I got shot the leg, I said, we're going to make it, you know. So you always have that positive attitude, you know. It's when you become your worst fear, you know, we're all afraid. But you take that fear and you use it in a positive means, and you go forward with it. You don't go backward with it, you know. And so that's what it is.
Gentlemen, I want to close tonight, and I promised that I would give you a little time. We left a lot of the story on the table because of time tonight. It was fantastic. But some closing thoughts about today's service and a message that we can give to some of these young officers. Gentlemen.
No, I just said something. I said something positive a while ago. It's like Tommy says, you know, we're so proud of each and every one of you. Everyone that serves our country today is going to serve and has served. You know, ladies and gentlemen, we've had, I think 44 million people to serve our great country. 44 million to give us the freedoms we enjoy here today. Today, right now, living in this country, we have 48,500,000 living in this veterans because of course, the size of our that's, and we have the greatest generation of World War II veterans who are passing away 1,000 a day, which my father is one of those people. You know, and if you can't get an inspiration from that, you know, are you young men and women serving this great country of ours, you know, I would have stayed in for another. They put me out for medical reasons, but I'd have stayed for 36 years. That's the reason I took a commission as an enlisted guy. But, you know, this nation is, like I say, I've been to 70 different countries. It is the greatest nation in the world. And we're very proud of you. I'd say 80% of this great country of ours is very proud of each and every one of you. You don't hear it enough, but I, my fellow recipients, and I know Tom, and I think a lot of people in this audience, we thank you from the bottom of my heart because you've taken our places, but just think there will be other young men and women that's going to take your place. And by with the patriotism we have in this great country of ours, which every man and woman in our country is a patriot. And what I try to say when I speak to everybody, this war has come to our front doors. And this war, this type of terrorism will try to take our country away from us if we all as Americans don't stand up and support you and support this nation. I really and truly don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I do care if you're an American. And we as a nation start doing what's right for our country. You know, we forget about the parties. Let's just do what's right for our country, the men and women that serve our country, and the men and women that live in our country. And most of all, for the children who are growing up in our country, so they can enjoy what I've enjoyed my lifetime, freedom. And I worry about it down, like I say, I worry about it down the line for my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, and their children. Because as I said before, we're a little bit over 200 and something years old, and most every major empire has crumbled after 200 years. And they never were overtaken. They're never overrun. They gave away their values, and they crumbled within. So always think about that, and always, as it all starts at home, always let your families know and your children know. But one thing I want to say from everybody, you know, I'm very proud of what's going on in our country today. I don't agree with everything. Who does? Nothing's perfect, but we're very proud of each and every one of you who serve our country.
I think you must have. You pretty much covered it. Pretty much what I was going to say. We live in the greatest country in the world, and we should be thankful that we do, and be appreciative of what it is that we have, and realize that in order to continue the freedoms and the greatness that this country has within itself, that we're going to have to at times fight for it. This terrorist issue is something that's a long-term event. I mean, I spent 20 years in the FBI, and most of it was working terrorism cases. The American public is not even aware of the cases that the incidences that we have prevented never coming to fruition because of we were able to intercept them before they were. We are susceptible to a major assault and incident. Hopefully, that'll never happen. We do have to be able to maintain the military and the forces that we have and the intelligence agencies that we have in order to minimize any of that ever occurring again. And like Mike said, it really doesn't matter, you know, whether you think you may not agree particularly with the method that we're using to doing that. That's one thing. However, never forget that. And it certainly is our freedoms and our abilities to disagree. But when we disagree to a point where it becomes a issue, don't ever think that the enemy doesn't utilize that, because they do. And it's not, it's the people that are hurt by that are the soldiers over there, or the individuals over there trying to preserve those freedoms for us, or the freedoms of the country that they're fighting in. And I don't really care what political party you're with either. That's not a big issue to me. What is an issue is what we should be doing, like Mike said, is we should be concerned about this country, and we should all be working together to ensure this country continues to be as free and continues to have the values that we all know and love. And I would like to thank those, our armed forces today, that are doing the job that they're doing. You know, I think if we could re-enlist, we probably would have done that. But they'd probably laugh at me too. But sincerely, always support the forces that the armed forces that we have. They're doing a job they were sent to do. And they need this country's support. We know what it was like not to have that. And it's not a good thing when you have to come back to a country that hates you for what it is you were sent to do. Thankfully, that hopefully we've learned from that, and we at least support the troops. We need to support this country as a whole, and that's pretty much the sum of it.
Let you young kids out there know, we have the greatest technology now today. We have the greatest of everything. But most important of all, we have the greatest men and women behind that technology, and that's you guys.
And that will do it for tonight. Our thanks to Tom Norris and Michael Thornton for joining us. Our thanks to Michael Thornton and Tommy Norris for joining us. You can learn more about us by visiting our website at PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org. For the library staff, the Chicago Humanities Festival, and everyone here at the Thorne Auditorium in Chicago, I'm Ed Tracy. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the library. This program was made possible by our sponsors, 2006-2007 season sponsors, McCormick Tribune Foundation, Turtle Wax, Karen L. Pritzker and Michael K. Vallock, Robert and Myrie Pritzker, Albert and Audrey Ratner. And our program sponsors, Chicago Sun-Times, IBS Futures, David Truitt. To learn more, visit our website at www.PritzkerMilitaryLibrary.org.
The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.